Well, tonight I have with me Paul Oliver, who I'm sure most of you know if you're familiar with the blues, and after all, I don't think anybody who doesn't like blues doesn't listen to this program. His most recent book, perhaps, is The Story of the Blues, or actually, what are your most recent ones, Paul? I think we saw some this the other day.
Just at the minute, I'm editing a series of blues paperbacks, and the first four of these have just come out, Chris. The first four titles are one on Ma Rainey and the classic blues, that's the whole classic blues genre, that's by Derek Stuart Baxter. And then there's one called Recording the Blues, which is by Bob Dixon and John Godrich. They're the authors of the Blues Bible, the discography, Blues Records, as you know.
The Old Testament.
The Old Testament, you might say, yes. And then there's a third one, which is my own, which is called Savannah Syncopators, which is really a study of African retentions in the blues, the degree to which Africa has influenced blues. And there's a fourth one, Blacks, Whites and Blues by Tony Russell. Blacks, Whites and Blues is really a study more of the interchange, cultural interchange between black traditions and white traditions in blues.
And what sort of brought you back over here?
Well, the thing that brought me back over here was the Ann Arbor Blues Festival. The festival, as you know, was a major event in the blues calendar, and from the point of view, our point of view in England at any rate, was a sort of phenomenal event last year. And I was completely flipped when they invited me to come over and MC the festival this year. And that's really what brought me over. And once over, of course, I set about traveling a little.
Yeah, I was at Ann Arbor too, and I certainly enjoyed it. I think you perhaps didn't, well, maybe you even got more of a feeling for it because you were, I think, certainly a very valuable asset. Rolling Stone doesn't mention your part in it, but to my way of thinking anyway, knowing what it takes sometimes to put on a successful concert and getting people on a stage and particularly off the stage, which is sometimes the harder job, so that they all have somewhat equal time and all get heard to the best advantage. I think you did a marvelous job of doing a very brief yet very effective kind of emceeing, and I'm sure you're English accent helped.
I don't know about that.
I think your knowledge of all the singers. I think you've we've both been. Actually, we met 10 years ago. Wasn't it? Where was that? In Memphis.
That was in Memphis. Yes, so almost 10 years to the day. Actually, we did a field trip then through Mississippi and Texas and Arkansas and Louisiana. And over here as well, still hunting a few people, and that was exactly 10 years ago. Well, quite a few of the people who were on the festival at Ann Arbor were people I hadn't seen for the past 10 years, and it was really nice that they remembered us, and it was great meeting old friends again.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think we both met them, and I think Mance Lipscomb was certainly one that you had seen since that
day. That's right,
day,
certainly, and, yes. And he really was playing as well as he ever was, you know. He was apologizing for his voice in those days, but he seems just as good to me now, and he certainly is quite a remarkable
amazing,
performer.
Yeah. I will never forget, it was the start of our Hooli Records, really, that summer of 1960.
The very first record, yes, that's right.
And it's been 10 years ago now. And it's really amazing to me how well all the artists get along, you know, on a program like that. Many of them have heard, I know that Mance was particularly, he asked me, come on, I really would like to meet Joe Turner. And so I just went over there to him and said, Joe Turner, I'd like to meet you, Mance Lipscomb. And Mance said, you know, I've heard about Joe Turner all these years. You know, he made records and he heard him on the jukebox and on the radio. And I know it was quite a thrill for him to talk to the man there in the flesh, as it was to meet Roosevelt Sykes, although he may have met him at some other festival. I'm not sure of
yes,
that.
Yes, I don't know whether he'd met him or not, but certainly I think all the blues singers that I met seemed to just appreciate the kind of atmosphere and the shared experience and the way in which everybody just enjoyed the music and participated. But I remember Robert Pete Williams said to me, using a phrase that seemed quite unlikely coming from his mouth, he suddenly said, man, we're all brothers here, aren't we? And it was really very nice, it was very moving, and coming straight up from Louisiana as he was, maybe he felt it particularly strongly. Certainly it touched me.
Mm-hmm. I, and I particularly sort of strikes me, because when they are on their own, many of these artists, especially people like Bobby Blueblind and so on, they really are superstars, you know, in their own right. That is, they travel alone with their own review or whatever it is, and in their own clubs, they are the stars. Yet when it comes to a festival like this, they really do treat each other pretty much as equals, that they're just all brothers. And at least I didn't observe any kind of...
Well, I think this is true. I think it's partly to the credit of the festival itself, because they didn't really build up to a climax each night. I mean, it probably was building that way in a certain sense, but every artist was important, and every artist had his particular enthusiasts in the audience. It was rare that any artist didn't get a standing ovation that was genuinely meant. And I think that this probably won the respect and probably even the surprise of some of the singers, but possibly the more sophisticated ones, and seeing how greatly respected many of the older men were. But I think that they appreciated it anyway. Perhaps it reminded them of their fathers playing or something, but all the way through it seemed to me they really did appreciate the work of the other men.
Also considering that some of them are really remarkable individualists, you know.
Well, I think they come over very strongly, and on these circumstances, almost more so. Maybe they're tempted to emphasize their own personalities, so the individuality of each artist seems to come over particularly effectively.
Well, we're talking about the Ann Arbor Festival. It's kind of a shame, if you have read the Rolling Stone issue, last one, Center Spread deals with it. Unfortunately, it probably won't happen again, because they lost a great deal of money, and it was sponsored partially by the... Was it the Episcopal?
It's the Episcopal Church, yes.
And the Student
the
Union.
The Student Union, Michigan Union, yes.
And of course, as most the religious and educational organizations are willing to lose a reasonable amount of money, and as Rolling Stone pointed out, up to $5,000, but this, unfortunately, the losses went up to over $20,000,
I think they were expecting a $25,000 loss.
It may not happen again, but I hope perhaps other students in some other areas. I know that... here at Berkeley, we certainly did. Joe Garrett did a very nice job in our putting on his blues festival in last April here, and they also lost money. But it wasn't. I'm not sure as to how the regions now look on, since all this kind of reaction to what goes on the campus. But perhaps Berkeley will come through and do one. Of course, the big problem we have here is the transportation. Most blues singers live on east of the Mississippi, or on the. On the riverbanks, but it's very expensive to bring them all the way to California.
I think that's a point that we ought to mention, is the extraordinarily good organization of the Ann Arbor Blues Festival. This was organized entirely by students. They had no other help. And the way in which they got all the artists to the site and got them back and saw that they were in comfortably situated in motels and generally looked after them in every kind of way, it took them 9 months of continuous preparation, but it really paid off. And I think that the good atmosphere throughout and all the apprehensions of the city fathers and so forth that there may be trouble were completely unfounded. And this was demonstrated, and demonstrated in all sorts of ways, just to the extent that the chief of police congratulated them on the way in which it was handled, which was quite nice. I think that all this sort of reflected the way in which the students, given the responsibility, could handle it and handle it exceptionally well. And although, you know, it would be nice to have another concert over here, yet Ann Arbor is a kind of unlikely place, and there's something very attractive about that. And I would personally like to see more concerts distributed around the country rather than centred on the extreme east or the extreme west coast.
That would be, of course, very nice too. And perhaps next year there'll be some strange little college comes up with a program of this kind. I also should point out that they did pay them rather well. I mean, it's hard to compare it with rock and roll artists' fees that some of them get, but it's certainly much better pay than the Newport Festival, which treats them all alike and pays everyone $50, and then the profits go to some unknown organization that no one really knows about. Very often it goes into the hands, of course, of researchers and so forth who will do field trips, but I think it's really best to put them in the pockets of the artists, put that money, whatever is made. I think they need it most.
I'd like to hear of anybody who actually did benefit from the Newport Foundation anyway, perhaps.
Yes, I would be curious to find out sometimes. Maybe if I have meet Ralph Rinsler out here, we can get some comments, or perhaps I get Mike Seeger to give me some enlightenment in that direction. And however, the only thing I felt could have been improved was the fact that country artists, especially the country blues singers like Manson, Robert Peet, and John Jackson, and so on, they're really that great attraction to be part of. It rests in the fact that they're incredible human beings that the public likes to meet and talk to them, hear their stories, and get some of their views on life and their experiences. And that is almost impossible in a concert setting, don't you feel?
Yes, I do agree. And in fact, I think that in that could be the salvation, in a sense, of the Ann Arbor Blues Festival in the future. If they could have sponsorship and support from the city and the university to put it on again, I think that what they could probably do is not invite just about every working blues singer there and make a grand festival with exposure for, say, 30 minutes by each artist, but rather reduce the number, but make them more available. A number of singers, a very large number, like Robert Peet Williams, who just mentioned, were there for all 3 days, and yet they were 30 minutes on stage, and for the rest of the time, just listening. They're really a kind of people who like to talk, and, as you say, you know, like to have personal contact, and anyway are fascinated and attracted by the fact that other people want to hear what they have to say. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that if they had a number of workshops, and that they devoted the mornings, for argument's sake, to workshops, which they easily could be, and perhaps made the concerts less than 13 hours long, as they were this time, this would be worthwhile, I think.
Because most of the kids actually were camped out there. It was nice weather, and they were there ready to be there in the morning.
That's right.
In that respect, Berkeley was better. We did have workshops here, and the audience could really meet these performers. And that was kind of nice. And also, we had relatively few performers, comparatively to speaking with Ann Arbor. You know, they were quite an army if you think of the expenses involved out here. And, I'd like to perhaps begin sort of back. I don't know whether people really know that the blues are really just sort of a hobby with you, aren't they? What is your real job that you make a living at, Paul?
Well, I make a sort of living by lecturing on architecture and art. I have a Department of Arts and History at the Architectural Association in London. The Architectural Association is an association which also has a School of Architecture. And I really spend, 3/4 of my time doing that, and the rest of the time, I suppose, writing about blues, as well as living, of course. You know, there has to be a little room for that.
Mm-hmm. And you also have a new book out
in that area too, yes. There's a book called Shelter and Society. My personal interest is in popular arts and folk arts anyway. It has always amazed me that so little attention has been given to popular architecture or folk architecture and sort of formal architecture, which has been called by Rudofsky architecture without architects, but I find this a very clumsy phrase. Anyway, it seems to me that the unifying factor is that of shelter, and the first volume is a collection of writings which I've edited by various specialists who've studied in depth particular societies and the relationship of their forms of shelter to the society. At the moment, I've just completed editing a second volume, which is on shelter in Africa, which is especially concerned with the nature of African societies over the continent and the changing effects of both the society and the environment and climate and natural resources upon the nature of building.
And you were actually fortunate enough, you did visit Africa, didn't you, prior to writing this book. Perhaps some of people have criticized you on your first blues book, but I don't think any of them know that you had never really been to this country.
That's quite true, yes.
Writing that one.
That's a long while ago. That was Blues Fellas Morning. It was published here as The Meaning of the Blues. Well, I wrote that. I finished actually writing it in 1958, and it's slightly galling to find that I'm continually quoted as if my opinions now are exactly the same as those of 12 years ago.
And unfortunately, it is perhaps the most widely distributed book of yours in this country, I think.
Yes, I think it is, too. Yes.
It's available in paperback now, and you can buy it in almost every airport.
It seems like it.
I hope they will eventually get around to your more recent ones, to Conversation with the Blues,
Screening the Blues.
I think it's called
Aspects of the Blues Tradition here. It's a more resounding title, but Screening the Blues had a particular significance to me anyway.
And so you did visit Africa and see things firsthand before you wrote?
My wife and I spent 4 months in Africa, during which time I was lecturing on architecture, and she was also teaching graphics to African students. But I was also at the University of Lagos and giving lectures in the Department of African Studies in the music division, under Kwabena Nketiah, who's probably the most important of the African musicologists on the music of Africa. And there I was lecturing, oddly enough, on the relationship of African music to Afro-American music, as we called it then. Well, the this gave me an opportunity both to further studies with people who were similarly interested, and subsequently I was able to do a lot of field recording for the BBC of African music from the rainforest coast into the savannah regions, and this gave me the first inklings of the possibility of a different theory, really, of the relationship of African music to blues and to other forms of black music in America.
Yeah, perhaps some people are kind of are flabbergasted or mystified by this title of the Savannah Syncopators. You want to just explain briefly what you're...
Well, it's a kind of joke. There was a band called Oliver's Savannah Syncopators, so that was more or less a private joke, but it wasn't really intended to refer to that, except that I thought that the phrase itself was actually extremely meaningful, because the points that I was trying to bring out in the book as a whole was that it was the music of the savannah regions which is far more related to jazz and blues than was the music of the areas which are normally considered the areas from which the slaves came, namely the rainforest regions. So in this term, which has already had something like 50 years of reference or 40 years of reference in the jazz field, it seemed to me was in fact a very major clue, and I couldn't resist using it. It's really all...
I think that's very interesting. Perhaps there are many blues fans, I'm sure, who don't know the Savannah Syncopators, that is King Oliver's thing, but perhaps they'll give a listen to that band. There is really a great deal of blues in early jazz, and although that division perhaps increased as jazz became more of a, or perhaps went further away from its roots.
Yes, I think this is probably so. I mean, but it's interesting to note that even one of its major recordings of that particular band, Black Snake Blues, was of course also the principal recording, perhaps, of Victoria Spivey. They were very close, and they were very well aware, I think, of the work of the blues singers at that time. Certainly, jazz probably diverged more and developed more instrumental forms of blues, but. It's a little myopic, I think, of blues collectors or of jazz collectors not to be aware of and to see the relationship between these musics.
And I think Europeans are more Catholic there, that they do seem to be interested in the entire broad spectrum of black music rather than picking a certain aspect. Here, I think jazz and blues fans are very far apart.
Well, I think some do in Europe. I mean, there is also the kind of specialization that you find anywhere else, and rather protected areas, so to speak, which particular enthusiasts wish to keep almost to themselves. But I think that this kind of eccentricity applies in any form of collecting. In Europe, the collector really has had to find his own way to a very large extent, and also not being in direct contact with the music, not perhaps just hearing it up the street, or being able to, even if he didn't actually go. He's been really forced on to recorded evidence and to study this and analyse it, and I think that this is the basis of the enormous amount of literature on jazz and on blues which has emanated from European countries, from France and Germany and from East Germany even, in the case of Theo Lehmann, and from Sweden and, of course, from England. This is always a source of surprise to American visitors, I find, but it really seems fairly logical to me.
And it's certainly remarkable how Europeans have expressed their interest in blues, and it has made possible these annual tours, not only of the American Folk Blues Festival, which does tour the continent and England, but individual tours by various artists who are perhaps even better known over there than they're here. I know it, I had never met Sonny Boy Williamson until I was on that tour when he was part of the American Folk Blues Festival. I didn't even know where he was from until...
Well, I think the first blues singers were coming over to England in the late 50s. Well, in fact, earlier, of course, in the sense that Lonnie Johnson and Big Bill Brunsey and then Bernie McGee and Sonny Terry had been visiting England fairly regularly from about 1951 on, and France. But by the late 50s, there was a fairly steady stream of blues singers like Roosevelt Sykes and Speckle Red and Little Brother Montgomery and Memphis Slim. Working, and some of them, of course, stayed in Europe, live there now, in fact. Yeah. Memphis Slim and Jack Dupree and Eddie Boyd and Mickey Baker, Curtis Jones, these are all blues singers who have actually found a very much more satisfactory milieu, perhaps, in France or in England, and they settled there. Sonny Boy himself wanted to do so, and it's sad that he died before he could.
I think especially the pianists apparently have had a more successful sort of retaining. I don't know, somehow they seem to be broader, and also they seem to appeal to jazz fans more.
Yes, I think this is true. The pianists, particularly in France, have been very successful. and this does reflect the interest of the jazz fan in that aspect of blues. And it dates back probably to the sort of boogie-woogie craze of the late 30s and 40s, which French collectors like Hugues Panassier, for example, advocated as an exciting kind of music. And up to a point, they bred a whole generation of enthusiasts for piano jazz, and as a side issue, piano blues as well. Certainly the guitarists weren't known in the way that they were here, I think. Nowadays, of course, they are, but probably there's more interest in the piano in Europe than there is in the United States. One of the things that disappoints me, really, is that so much in the way of opportunities for actual field research have been missed because of the preference for the guitar and the preference for Mississippi blues. It parallels a little bit the New Orleans emphasis, so that the possibility of studying jazz in Jacksonville, Florida, or in Mobile or Biloxi or whatever, you know, whether it was there or not, has just been ignored because all the emphasis has gone on New Orleans. In much the same way, jazz traditions elsewhere in the United blues traditions elsewhere in the United States have been overlooked with this great emphasis on the Mississippi guitarist. It seems to be unfortunate.
You know, we just mentioned the other day, it seems like to me sometimes as if every aspect of the blues has been well documented and recorded, and where do you think this is going to? Do you think we can continue exploring the blues?
Well, as you'll remember, Matt McCormick and myself have been working, and you've helped us for the last 10 years on a sort of regional study of Texas blues, and this we're just sort of winding up now, and we hope we'll be in print in not too far distant future. And that is essentially a regional study, but it does seem to me that there are other areas that could be examined in the same way or in that kind of depth. And there are many other aspects. Recently, it's been interesting to note the greater interest in musicological aspects of blues, and a number of writers like David Evans and Bill Ferris and well, really several others, John Fay and so on, have been more interested in the music that the blues singers have made and the way in which they play their instruments and what they've actually innovated there and analysed it from a musicological point of view. This can be a slightly academic exercise, and I wouldn't advocate it as the main direction which blues research should go, but it's very good that these areas, which have been largely overlooked by people like myself, for example, not particularly well equipped to do that, are now being examined, and this probably is certainly one of the directions anyway.
Yes, and it always strikes me how, you know, I always feel that maybe I've recorded really the last of the greater important blues singers, yet so many blues singers are such strong individuals, unlike in any other form of music that I know of. At least I can't think of any immediately. Where even the third and fourth generation, you know, once you get to know them, they're really very remarkable individuals who are constantly a blending of their traditions, yet also being innovators at the same time. And it seems to keep going in a way.
Well, it does seem to keep going. I have a continual feeling, or developing feeling, that it is grinding slowly to a halt as a music anyway of direct inspiration, largely of Black America. And as we've also been discussing recently, it does seem that there is a sort of genuine basis for a sort of multiracial kind of music, so to speak, which has blues as its base. Nevertheless, I'd agree that the succeeding generations do seem to come up with new young musicians, and if they're not in quite the numbers that they were before, it still seems to be in a pretty healthy state as yet.
Well, I'm speaking with Paul Oliver tonight on tonight's program of Music in America. Perhaps it's comments on America, perhaps, more appropriate. And Paul and I met 10 years ago for the first time when I was really on my first trip through the South recording I didn't really know what I was getting into. I had sort of hopes to start a record label, but I had never imagined that this would all become almost a pop music, which it has done in these last 3 years in particular, since I guess the British group sort of brought it all back home, and bluesers seem to continue to be a very kind of music that we all feel in one way or another. And as you mentioned, it's becoming perhaps an interracial type of music, a new kind. But the form seems to fit whites, and I think one of your books that you've edited perhaps might shed some light on that, that the whites have always perhaps been just as fond of the blues as blacks. I mean, who did we sort of compare it to the other night when we listened to Charlie Musselwhite? You know, you brought out the parallel to in the 20s when Big Spiderbeck or Charlie or Jack Teagarden.
Yes, well, that's true. We were considering the fact that, anyway, Charlie rather reminded us of Jack Teagarden, and his kind of approach to singing was really related to that of the jazz musicians in their relationship to the black musicians who'd come up from New Orleans. And this is kind of rather a complicated parallel, but it did seem to strike us at the time. I think it still strikes me in a way. But the point that Tony Russell is trying to make in Blacks, Whites and Blues is that at the more ethnic level, so to speak, of blues, there was also this kind of interchange. And in fact, the very use of language and the kind of repertoire that both blues singers and white singers from the sort of hillbilly country traditions were drawing upon was often very, very close indeed, often paralleled and sometimes exactly the same repertoire. What he's documented is the way in which these interleaved. The tendency for collectors to divide and to parcel things very neatly into particular and separate sections has meant that the hillbilly collector now has his particular group, his circle, his record labels, his magazines, and the blues collector has his group and his pals and his friends and his group of magazines, and the two just never meet. Nobody would believe that they're all part of a folk tradition of music of the American South, for argument's sake. Mm-hmm. But in fact, as Tony has tried to demonstrate, there is a close relationship. Sometimes at their polarities, they're very far apart, but they also do meet and overlap and intertwine. And this is hardly to be wondered at, bearing in mind that the cultures were in fact really growing together in the South, not and so
it's,
separate.
It's still continuing, really, just as strong as ever, I would think. You know, in the rock and roll business, after all, it was Elvis Presley and innumerable whites who really took on the blues, or at least in the beginnings, and even John Mayall and so on, who's now gone into a very much softer kind of thing, but yet they all start with the hard thing and then develop their own.
Yes, this is true. Well, blues is from there. Blues has certainly been a fountainhead of ideas and inspiration, and I think that it probably the borrowings of the earlier white musicians were more from blues than the reverse. The blues singers from the hillbilly singers, but and it's certainly true, I think, that in the past several years that this has accelerated and it's far greater now than it was in the past.
It's true. I guess the Charlie Prides are rather rare, that is, a black man singing hillbilly music. And it was perhaps just as rare in the early days, wasn't it?
Yes, I think it was rare, especially any that actually specialising in hillbilly kind of music. But of course, you've got groups like the Mississippi Sheiks who used a sort of rather hillbilly technique, and you've got singers like Blind Willie McTell singing Hillbilly Willie's Blues, you know, which are really hillbilly in style and deliberately so. And you've got Josh White singing with the Carver Brothers in a totally hillbilly way, so you'd never believe that he was on the record. And you've got Buddy Woods, who, you know, the blues singer, the Lone Wolf, singing, or playing at least, as a support to Jimmy Davis, you know, then a popular country artist, and so on. So that really, if one really examines the record, the relationship was a lot closer than perhaps we have come to expect or to realise.
Because we really don't know, do we, as to when they really became a separate forms of music? Because don't you think the early blacks, you know, in Civil War days and so on, were playing a music that was there really a distinct black and white music, do you think, in those days?
The writings and observations from that period are rather few, but those that exist, such as Lieutenant Higginson's, for example, the recollections of army life in a black regiment, or in which he quotes a number of songs sung by blacks within the regiment, and of course the very important collection of slave songs from the United States, published around about 1862. These do indicate that there were certain qualities of colour and approach to the music which were already quite specifically black. You know, in other words, that many of the white people who were collecting them found it totally unfamiliar, found it very difficult to transcribe as in any musical notation, had to invent notations to try and explain what was happening in the way of the singing. So that there was a cultural division there, but at the same time they were nevertheless singing within a structure which was very largely European in origin, which they often sang in a sort of ballad form which was again European in origin, and they were singing words and in a language which was European. So that what one really has to try and unravel are the elements which were essentially black and those which were European in base. What was happening was that one was seeing the emergence of a music of a particular kind of quality, which probably segregation actually had forced and emphasized into one of its own tradition.
Now, we mentioned that 10 years ago we both started traveling together, and my aim, I guess, was largely to make records. And have you seen any, what strikes you as perhaps the biggest change or the least changes over these last 10 years that that you can...
What, in the South or in the blues field?
Well,
or
I think in the blues field and the South. Or
well, it's really rather difficult to answer. I think that things have certainly changed, and in American life as a whole, it has impressed me a lot that there's far more discussion of social issues than there was 10 years ago, and a greater frankness, and on the whole, more willingness, in fact, to meet them and to endeavour to combat such issues, whatever they might be. I mean, whether it's homosexuality or abortion, or whether it's matters of race issue. That these are being dealt with far more honestly than they were only a decade ago. I mean, it greatly disturbed us at that time how anything that was a little disturbing was avoided, and that there was so much discomfort when one raised an issue which was unpalatable. And this is not the case now, and I find this very heartening. It shows a sort of maturity of attitude which I feel will be very important in the next few years. So that at a very serious level, which doesn't necessarily particularly involve blues at all, I do feel that this is, you know, an agent for major change. As far as blues is concerned, the even in those 10 years, I think there's been a decline in the actual activity within the clubs and so on. And I even suspect that there is some kind of relationship between those two facts, that blues is probably not a music of protest, as some would like to believe, but it is was that of a very definitely divided society. And although it's a very painful process, and the divisions in a sense are emphasised in some areas at the present time, yet the kind of confrontations and sometimes the kind of meetings that are taking place now maybe just makes blues a little less necessary. This, you know, could probably be considered as rather fanciful. I, however, somehow feel it.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah, I think the increasing interest on the whites is there because we all feel sometimes very powerless sort of to change things, and after all I think that's what brought us to the blues, sort of that you within yourself you feel is a kind of a lack of something, and you want I don't know if I can.
Well, I think this is really very difficult actually to analyze precisely what one's motivations are or why one is interested. I have been, you know, all my life deeply involved in blues and in other forms of folk music, popular music, not particularly that, just popular arts, as I mentioned before, but more especially blues, I suppose. And in making the trip that we did 10 years ago, my own reason was just that I wanted to meet the blues singers, find out how they lived, what they had to say, what their life was like, and what the situation was at that point in time. As there was remarkably little interest, I must admit, over here in general. It was a great delight to me to be able to make contact with you just by letter, and that we would do this together. I discovered by some mutual acquaintance that you were also going to make a trip, and it just seemed a great idea if we all met. Of course, we hadn't met at all before. We didn't know what it was going to turn out. And I always remember that we chose that sort of classic locale in blues collecting, which is the Peabody Hotel, Memphis, because this is where so many recordings were made. And I had not the remotest idea what it was like, and it could have been a very run-down shack if it even existed. And it was a great surprise to me to find that there we were meeting in the plushiest of interiors, when in our economy at that date we looked very out of place. I remember that we promptly moved off to try and find some cheaper motels, but it was a good start.
Yes, I think you're right. At that time, there was still a lot of blues activity in Houston and in even in Clarksdale and so forth, where there's, I think, almost nothing left of that sort of thing. It's now all jukeboxes and very little live music, and what there is more the kind of middle-of-the-road black music that is soul music now, we call
yes,
it.
Yes.
Or rhythm and blues, which is much more of a middle-class music. But I think perhaps black people might be interested in, you know, what drives whites towards the blues, why we love it, and you gave your reason for it. And I think initially I was struck by it. I came over here being also born in Europe, and it just struck me as one of the most direct and emotional kinds of music I'd ever heard. And of course, as a youngster, I was very insecure. You know, one is always thinks one's parents don't understand one, and one is lost and looking for a goal, and one clings to something, and I think most youngsters find this sort of emotional attachment in rock music and in their popular music. But I know many of my peers, they either found it in hillbilly music or in jazz or in blues or in other forms of ethnic music that really weren't part of their own tradition.
Yes, I think that's a very, very interesting point, and I think probably many of us who were interested in blues at that time had similar kind of psychological reasons for it. And it is interesting that if blues is becoming the sort of music of today outside of mainly black America, but America as a whole, it is nevertheless the music of a generation. It seems to me that it's the sort of under 25s and really the under 20s who for the most part are embracing blues very much as their music now. And this possibly reflects something of the sort of schism in American society as there is elsewhere. I mean, it's not just as essentially here, but the to renew the old cliche of the generation gap, nevertheless one that exists, and a sort of feeling of segregation, so to speak, horizontally through the society rather than perhaps vertically as the segregation of races had been in earlier decades in the century. Possibly, you know, almost intuitively, the generation of younger people now have felt that kind of contact with the music that seemed to express something of frustration and the energy, too, of minority groups.
And perhaps it also reflects, I sometimes feel, a lack, or it illustrates a lack of culture or a tradition in the American middle class. And you think, I mean, many youngsters, although they act as if they are against their own traditions, yet they try to form a new tradition. I mean, the whole hippie culture to me seems like a real attempt to form a very strong family tie of some kind.
Possibly a different kind of family.
But though, on an entirely different level. Yeah.
Yes, certainly.
And
this is true.
I think that the fact that we do not have, you know, a strong tradition like the Mexican American or the Indian or the blacks and so on, that we cling to other cultures and sort of begin to idolize them sometimes.
Well, possibly. I do wish that we could move out of the area of idolatry of blues singers. I mean, I think that many young militant black Americans resent white interest in blues, and actually resent blues anyway, because they feel that it is a sort of echo of the past and of a generation of their parents which perhaps weren't militant enough or strong enough. And I think that they also feel that there's an element of condescension, and they possibly resent too the tendency to put blues singers on a sort of pedestal. But this is almost inevitable, I think, in any kind of specialised area where certain people attain a particular kind of peak of quality which one admires and respects. But nevertheless, I do, in a sense, wish that this would go and that people would recognize the more remarkable thing, in a way, that those very ordinary people were actually creating a music of great vitality. And this is really far more important than thinking of them as somehow rather separate and relating them, therefore, to stars and to showbiz and to somehow Hollywood values.
I think in this new hip culture, I guess that's what you should call them, the new generation, sort of, I do find that there's a comeback of sort of pride in their own heritage. I've noticed, especially with people who come from the hillbilly or what should I say, you know, country and western tradition, who've become hip kids, but who are now very proud to play country and western music. We have a Commander Cody and his Lost Planet Airmen here, who have become very popular, who sing simply tavern music of the 50s, you know. And they have a large following here, and at least it seems to me that the audience very much identifies with them and sort of are proud of the fact that maybe we are. That is part of our culture, you know, and in this new environment belonging to this new hip culture, they can take a pride in it.
And can take a pride in it. And I think that this actually, for me, has been one of the major revelations of this particular trip after 10 years. Just going back to going to Mandrake's Club the other night and hearing Charlie Musselwhite, as I mentioned to you at the time, the thing that really impressed me and really struck me, apart from the vitality of the music, were the number of young black Americans who were there also. And this was great, I felt, you know, and I had not really, up until that time, appreciated that they're all young people enjoying the music and not attaching colour preference or any other kind of artificial structure to it. And for me, not having experienced this in Europe and having been away from the States for 10 years, this was really a major kind of discovery, in a sense, or realisation, and I think very important to shaping one's attitude to the way in which the music is going now and its importance today.
Well, and in between your emceeing the Ann Arbor program and now just winding up your short stay here, where did you go?
Well, we flew from Ann Arbor, or at least from Detroit, to Phoenix, to violently hot Phoenix. And after mastering the mysteries of the American automatic left-hand drive car, we which is about twice as long as the one we've got at home, we gradually made our way into somewhat cooler regions, a little bit further north, and then to the desert regions of the Navajo and Hopi reservations. This was very interesting and very exciting for me because my interest in the culture of the North American Indian has been with me at least as long as that of an interest in blues, but I've never felt that I could make any kind of contribution to those studies, but I'd always wanted to go to these regions, and so my wife, and eventually we managed to do so. We went to the intertribal ceremonial at Gallup in New Mexico, and this was a very interesting experience in itself, not only because at the more superficial level it gave us an opportunity to see the dances of a number of tribes being performed, but at the deeper, more significant level, I think, it gave us an indication of the kind of frustrations that the young Navajo Indians are also experiencing, because at this time there were protests by the young Indians against the very tribal ceremonial itself. And this was based on the fact that it had been a purely white-inspired ceremonial, always has been.
Sort of
49 years they'd been promoting it, and even the very ushers that we saw right at the entrance and encountered the people who took our money and who gave us our tickets and then collected our tickets and showed us to our seat, and the whole rigmarole was entirely Anglo, as they say in that area. And this struck us very forcibly, even before we encountered the Navajo militants. My sympathies are entirely with them, because although I did enjoy the ceremonial and the dances and so forth, and the music and the rodeo, and it was great, and it was an opportunity for us to see a kind of crash course in what survives American Indian culture, yet one was fully aware that it wasn't the real thing at all. And what was more important to us was to visit the reservations and try to make some minute contact, not very much of course in the space of that time, but enough perhaps to give us a sort of a start on trying to study on the site, so to speak, something of both the Indian culture in its traditional form and its struggle with survival and sort of the problems of trying to equate with the rest of American society at this time.
Do you think there's any kind of parallel between the Indians' an attempt on one hand, of course, to preserve their culture and their way of living, yet on the other also being part of the American mainstream and having the economic sort of satisfaction of owning cars and a house perhaps, and the blacks also wanting to preserve their sort of soul culture, yet at the other hand also wanting to participate in the economic, is there?
I think there are some parallels, but there are differences also. There are certainly parallels. But not all blacks by any means seem to want to preserve their culture. They see themselves as Americans and want to be American and integrated and all the rest of it as soon as possible. I don't think that they're so consciously aware of having a culture that is specific and clear. There's no question about the nature of indigenous cultures which existed in North America before the whites came and have continued to struggle and survive against increasing pressures and pressures within themselves, for that matter. But there's no question about those being quite specific cultures inspired on the continent and being a part of the lifestyle of the people. So they're not exactly comparable, it seems to me, but probably the struggle is very much the same. However, they have a particularly difficult one because the breakdown of tribal society is almost inevitable in the assimilation of American values and material, as well as all the others, if there, you know, how many there are, but certainly the assimilation of the material culture. And the way in which the Hopi and the Navajo have tackled this problem independently and quite differently, it was one of the things that interested me, absorbed me most. The Navajo are, possibly because of their better stability of their economy through the uranium strikes, are using their new wealth very wisely and distributing this slowly through the community, through sort of social welfare to a very large extent, but not impairing the largely or semi-nomadic way of life of many of the Navajo. The Hopi, I think, are trying to achieve it by retrenchment. They are actually sort of settling on the mesa and no longer are tourists really welcome, certainly not welcome with cameras at all, and the roads aren't made up, and in one way or another they're trying to preserve what remains of their culture, more or less by separation. There's no electricity there, therefore there's no television there, and there's a good deal less sort of contact that way. I think it's partially successful, but for the new generation of younger Indians, it inevitably must be traumatic, I should think.
Yeah, that's what sort of struck me as this incredible difference there between, you know, you're confronted as a child, what am I going to do? You know, am I going to stay on this reservation and live like my great-grandparents, or should I try to make it in the city? This must be really traumatic, as you said it.
Mm. Well, one of the things that worries me greatly, the process of termination of reservations where the Indian populace is being sort of distributed, so to speak, or shipped abroad, so to speak, as if it didn't exist, and gradually wiped off the map. And this is not finishing. As I understand it, this is still continuing, very much so. And they gravely concerned about the lack of responsibility to the Indian, not everywhere, but still to a remarkable degree. And if this isn't going to be the next crisis issue, I'll be very surprised.
Did you notice anything as to their music? You know, after all, it's I think on most of our trips, one is exposed to many kinds of music. Every time I go to the Southwest, I'm more and more fascinated by Mexican-American music. And I was wondering whether you had any thoughts about the Indians and their music.
Well, of course, the Indian music is, to a very large extent, at least I say Indian, I'm only talking now about really two tribes. The music has some secular aspects. Amongst the Navajo, there appear to be, to me, far more secular songs than there are amongst the Hopi. This is partly due to the fact that the Hopi religious life is very rich and involves them in ceremonials throughout the year, particularly from January to July, in which the music and dance are totally integrated and are very much an essential part of the sort of living culture. The Navajo do have sacred dances and sacred music, and this is important to them, but they also seem to have, in Yabuchi and so on, more secular songs. Whether these are being assailed by the music that they hear on the jukeboxes and so on, it's really very difficult for me, you know, in so brief a contact, to be able to ascertain. It seems to me that possibly that they're running in parallel. What I couldn't hear was the any indication of a kind of amalgam, sort of a halfway house between the traditional and the popular music, which you probably do find in black music in the South.
And that struck me very much the same. You say it's the parallel. That struck me because I've only heard it on the radio. When you drive through Gallup, for example, there are two radio stations that are devoted about half time to catering to the Indians. They have an Indian announcer and so on. And it seems to me the most popular music is country and western, and yet they do play pure Indian chant music, you know, with just drums and so on, the other half. But there are no groups that are kind of a mixture. That I noticed that. Just from their records, as I say.
Yes,
I would think that.
Well, studies in blues, at any rate, in the past few years, seem to have shown that the evidence on recorded music was a good deal more accurate a picture of the music that was being played in the 20s and 30s than perhaps we'd suspected. And this may well be so in Indian music too. Maybe what you hear on the car radio, so to speak, is a fairly accurate picture of the situation at present. Of course, it seems to me that there's just not enough research being done in this area. The ethnomusicology magazines and so on, which I look at, always seem to give the emphasis upon the traditional, the surviving elements, and not sufficient upon culture change. And this is all important. The culture is never static. There is no such thing as a static culture. It's always in a process of change, either a very slow process or a very dynamic process. We're in a stage in time when these processes are being accelerated, and it seems to me the responsibility of the anthropologist and the ethnomusicologist to be studying this and to draw what lessons that he may from it, and perhaps feed this back into an understanding of the dilemma that faces the minority cultures.
Yeah, that always struck me. That's perhaps why I was so turned off by academic approach to, you know, folk music and so on. I once tried to take a course and I almost flunked it because they seem to be so pedantic in their little, you know, studies of as these sort of remnants of the most archaic elements, yet they completely neglect the living folk music of the people, which is in constant flux and in changing, you know, just like Cajun music or whatever. It's constantly undergoing changes and modifications and sort of an evolution.
Well, the day is yet to come that blues is a respectable subject, for example, to study in any kind of way in a university. If you want to, by any chance, write a thesis on blues, you've got to go under the guise of a student of Shakespeare and literature, or you've got to be a student of mythology and folklore, and after ploughing through Nordic myths, eventually you can come out with your thesis, maybe. But at the moment, there's a reluctance, it seems to me, in the academic world to face the music as it is, in other words, the culture as it is. And this, I'm sure, is an indictment of some order.
I think a good deal of the blame for that is, I would say, that the academicians have a tendency to really live in their little ivory towers, that they are really sort of scared of going out there and exploring what exists in their own neighborhood.
I think this is probably so, but then, of course, many anthropologists are working continually in the field. However, it probably relates back a little bit to the incentive in the first place, actually, to do the field work. I used to be called a romantic as far as writing about blues is concerned. No doubt it was quite true. In fact, one has to be, in a sense. It's impossible to be totally objective and go out in the field, or indeed get a complete involvement in the music or culture of another society, and be just coldly and completely objective, if in fact such objectivity could be achieved, or if it were desirable to achieve it. In fact, you have to be a kind of romantic, but inevitably that romanticism takes on many colours, and one of them, I at least is believe, I think, is that there's a reluctance to accept the fact that the culture that you admire is in a process of change or decay or altering, or that a new one is emerging. And maybe it's just one of the other sides of it. However, in the academic world, supposedly, the academic world is is being as objective as it can be, and what is being objective about is the studies of the romantics of another age. What it's failing to be at the moment is sufficiently objective about the studies of the romantics of the present.
Very well put, I think. Well, Paul, perhaps we can wind up this program with a sort of perhaps a brief review or some comments on what I consider perhaps your most important book, and that's The Story of the Blues. Largely because I feel it should be in every library in this country, certainly, and perhaps in most European countries. And I think you started it as with a kind of an exhibit at the American Embassy, wasn't it, in London some years ago?
Yes, this was in 1964. The then cultural affairs officer, Francis Mason, invited me to put on an exhibit of the blues. I should mention that the American Embassy at that time, before the big financial cutback, was a real cultural centre in London of great vitality. It was one of the most exciting places in London, and we look back to those days of a remarkable exposure of the American arts with real nostalgia. It was a very exciting time, and possibly the embassies these days are not doing that service as well as they might be. Probably they think that the battle is won in Great Britain. I'm not sure that they're quite right about that, but this was really exciting, and the opportunity, therefore, to put on an exhibition of blues at the American Embassy was a tremendous one, a very exciting one for me. In fact, it became an enormous exhibition of over 500 photographs and reproductions of ephemera, beautifully displayed, and took over the major hall in the big Saarinen and embassy building in Grosvenor Square, and was in fact the most successful exhibition they ever had. They put it on first of all for 3 weeks, then for 5 weeks, then for 8 weeks, and thousands of people visited it. This really broke the back as far as I was concerned, in collecting all the photographs and doing the captions and preparing all the material and putting it into some kind of order. And I really felt that this ought to be in some book form. The problem was finding a publisher who also thought so. But eventually, anyway, we did get a publisher, and rather belatedly, but with much new material. Rather good that it was belated, because a number of other blues singers had been discovered and far more information had been brought to light. And the book was completed and published about 9 months ago.
And it really presents the entire history of the blues in pictorial form, and plus a very elaborate and precise text.
It was a very difficult thing to write, actually, because of that.
So.
They asked for 200 illustrations and 40,000 words, and it ended up as being rather more than 80,000 words and 500 illustrations. But the publisher was very kind-hearted about this enormous growth in the book itself in the process of producing it. And I feel that at least it, you know, achieved that end anyway, that gave a sort of a basic historical background, at least I hope so.
And if any of you are wondering where you can buy it cheaper than at your local bookstore, you should be aware of the fact that Blues Unlimited, the perhaps the world's leading magazine devoted to the blues, also located in Britain, in Bexhill-on-Sea, at 38A...
Sackville Road.
Sackville Road.
Bexhill-on-Sea, Sussex.
In Sussex. Yeah. Yeah. Does sell it for almost half the price that the bookshops here.
Yes, I don't quite know why that is. I don't know why the price is so high. Here's $12.50 here, it's £3 something there. But if you write to the editor of Blues Unlimited, they will doubtless send it to you, I believe, post-free. Mm-hmm. Not sure this is good advertising ploy, but anyway, that's the fact of the matter. The publisher can work it out for himself.
And we started the program with mentioning some of you're editing a series of paperbacks dealing with very specific subjects related to the blues. What else can we look forward to in that?
Well, some of the people that I've mentioned earlier on as doing research in musicological and other aspects of blues are publishing paperback books in the series, so that forthcoming ones, they include David Evans, who's writing a book on the blues singer Tommy Johnson, and he's writing another one on the sort of central Mississippi, scene around Jackson, Mississippi, and Drew, in other words, showing the whole culture. William Ferris is doing a book on the creative process in blues, as exemplified by field recordings that he made in the Delta. There's a book on Little Brother Montgomery and all the people that he knew and the kind of piano culture, particularly of Mississippi, by Karl Gotzer Heide, who's a German writer on blues. I have been trying to get writers from outside America and Britain. As I say, Karl Gotzer Heide is German. Bengt Olsen is Swedish. He's done some 3 months of research in Memphis and has been studying the development of the Memphis blues and jug bands, and he has done a book on that. John Fay wrote a master's thesis on the music of Charlie Patton. It was the first musicological study of a blues singer to be made, and we're publishing that as a textual and musicological study of a major formative blues singer. Currently, research is being done by Bruce Bastin in the Carolinas, and we should be publishing next year a book based on this research, a second field trip that he's made. And also currently, Mike Rowe is doing research on the last generation of the Chicago bluesmen in Chicago, and this too will be published as a book. So you can see that we're working towards a dozen or 16 titles in the series. They're published by Stein and Day here in paperback, and there are in fact some hardbacks as for people who want a solid piece of literature on the shelf. Otherwise, they're paperbacks here, and they're published by Studio Vista in Britain.
Well, thank you very much, Paul. I've been talking to Paul Oliver tonight, and it's been Music and Talk in America. Thank you. Good night.